Welcome to the She Wears Armor podcast. I'm your host, Heather Lauder. I'm a daughter of the king, a wife, a mama to six, podcaster, coach, and advocate. I'm a survivor of domestic abuse and a former family law paralegal. I know you thought getting away from your abuser would feel like freedom, but now it seems like staying would have been easier. You're not only battling your ex, now you're up against a broken justice system, agencies that are corrupt, and dealing with officials who act like you're a bother. You are emotionally and financially drained and don't know how much more you can handle. If you're ready to build and implement a strategic action plan for your high conflict court case, find healing after toxic relationships, and learn your true identity in Christ, go grab a caffeinated drink, a notepad, and that favorite pen you probably took from someone, and let's get cracking. Hey sisters, welcome back. Today in part two of my testimony, you will hear about the battle's fought, the victories won, and most importantly, how I found strength in surrendering it all to God. I hope that my story will uplift and encourage you and point you to Jesus Christ, the only one who can give you everything you need. Let's get started. Please be aware that any advice provided is not to be considered legal counsel or therapy. I am not a licensed attorney or therapist, and my responses are for informational purposes only. For specific legal or therapeutic concerns, please consult with a qualified professional in the respective field. Hey guys, before we dive in, just a quick reminder. Please share this podcast with your friends, screenshot it, share it on your Instagram and Facebook, and be sure to tag me in it so I can give you a shout out and a thank you. Make sure you're following all of my social media accounts to keep up to date on what's going on. I would also love to discuss some of these topics with you and get your ideas about what you want to hear on this podcast. Find me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Hit the follow or subscribe button so you'll receive notifications when something new is happening. Please, and most importantly, take a minute to give me some stars and write a little review on Apple iTunes. This is how you can help other women find my content. The ranking will boost me up in the algorithm so they can get the help for themselves or someone they love. All right, let's go. It wasn't long that I was ready to give up my life in Florida. There was nothing good about it. I was ready to move on to the better one that this guy promised me. Anything had to be better than the mess I had back home. I had pressure coming from every which direction. Don't think it wasn't a tough decision because I had finally made it into law enforcement and I really was working hard. And I even had the blessing of getting to work side by side with that deputy that walked into my classroom. The blonde-headed, beautiful woman that came in a deputy's uniform was working at the sheriff's office still, and I got to meet her, I got to hang out with her, and become close with her. And I had a lot of other people that were like family to me. That was hard for me to give up, but I had to make some choices. There were things that I can't talk about on here that were going on, and I needed to make a decision that protected me and my girls. Gonna see if I can keep recording this. It's that time of day where Brody wants to sit at the window and cry for his daddy. So you might hear the little wiener dog in the background again. But anyway, I decided that everywhere I turned was a battle and I was alone. I sold everything I could, packed up the rest, and I moved to the mountains of North Carolina in the late summer of 2004. Within that year, Doug barely answered the phone. He was even more absent from the girls' lives. He was involved in a car chase that ended in him hitting someone else while he was driving drunk. I thought maybe I'd made the right decision getting away from there. There were some things going on that I didn't want me, let alone my girls, involved in, but the shine was wearing off of this new relationship I was in. He was starting to change, and I was isolated from everyone and everything. I had already sold my car and I didn't have a job outside of the home. What was I going to do? Call my family? Tell them I was wrong? That wasn't going to happen. We had beef. I can fix this. I can handle this. I'll just work around his anger. I will save him. I will fix him. I will handle this. I am responsible. At the end of November in 2005, I had to return to Okeechobee for the hearing for mine and Doug's divorce. The guy that I won't name drove me down there. sat outside in the parking lot and waited for me to return. Long story short, Doug and I worked through our divorce amicably. And as a matter of fact, when we went before the judge, he asked me, who completed this paperwork? I said, I did. He said, no one helped you. No, sir. Doug and I worked everything out between us and I completed the paperwork. The judge said, I've never had one that I didn't have to send back for something. I'm impressed. When the judge was done, Doug literally gave me a pat on the back for what the judge said as we were walking out. We went our separate ways and I came back to the mountains. Just a few short days later, I got a phone call late one evening. It was Doug's brother, and as anyone does, I was trying to come up with a reason he would be calling me, especially late. Before answering the phone, I remember thinking, I'm glad that guy isn't here. I guess we really need to call him something so it's not so confusing, so we'll just call him Abuser. How about that? Anyway, this phone call would be a reason that he would get angry and I would have to pay for it some way or another. Anyway, I answered and his brother said, Doug's been shot. I said, what? He's been shot. My brain automatically goes to fixing this. I thought, okay, well, he's okay. So I asked, is he okay? No, Heather, he shot himself in the head. I don't remember what I said after that. My girls were asleep in their beds. I was alone, and I just went to my knees. I needed answers, but there were none. I don't even know what I was thinking other than, please, God, no. This is not someone that you would ever expect that this would happen to, that he would do something like that. It was so out of left field. I think I would have understood better if they would have said he was in a wreck or he was in an accident or something. But to know that he took his own life, that was a whole different ballgame. And I was just in total shock. I don't remember how long it took me to call the abuser. He was at a fire department working. So he was staying the night there. Supposedly that was where he was. Anyway, I know that even though what I was going through, I was aware that I needed to be concerned. I needed to think about how he was going to react to this news or me breaking this news to him, because somehow it would be misconstrued that if I showed any kind of feeling that it was because I wanted Doug back or so many things other than I was in shock that the father of my children killed himself. But I had to do something. I was just doing nothing and I just didn't know what to do. I called him, I gave him the news, and he came home from the fire department. And I just kept saying, how am I going to tell the girls? What do I say? I was agonizing. I was in total anguish over telling them. Finally, I went to bed. I guess I fell asleep at some point, but when I woke up the next morning, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I didn't want the sun to rise because I knew when I saw that sun, I was going to have to face telling my two little girls that this happened. I didn't want to hurt my babies like this. The abuser tells me that he's going to help me. So we go to their room and ask them to sit on the bed because I needed to tell them something. I just recall their little feet hanging off the side of the bed and me not being able to make the words come out. I couldn't even breathe. I look up at their little faces and they're looking at me with their big wide eyes, knowing something is really wrong. And before I could get the words out, the abuser says, "Your dad's dead." They look at him all confused. I look at him with shock, like, what are you doing? They look at me and all I know to do was just grab them and hold them. They were confused. They were only 4 and 7. And it was like the abuser was proud of himself and it was just no big deal. I tried to focus on not reacting to him because I knew that this moment would be one that they would remember and didn't want to make it any worse than it already was. I answered the few questions that they had and told them that we were going to be going down to Okeechobee for a few days. The look on the abuser's face was clearly, no, you're not. Later on, out of earshot of my daughters, we got into a heated discussion over me going to Florida for Doug's funeral. He kept using my daughters. You shouldn't expose them to that. You can go if you want to, but you should just leave them here. Now, I understand that he knew I was not going to leave them. He knew that if they didn't go, then I wouldn't go. I am so glad I didn't listen to him. I packed our stuff, got in the truck that only had his name on it, by the way, and drove to Florida. That was a very long 11-hour drive. I made it to my mama's and stayed with her. The next day, I had to take my girls to get dresses to wear to their dad's funeral. My mom stayed home instead of going with me and the girls. So again, alone, I drove to Walmart. The entire time I was trying not to break down, and I was getting messages from the abuser about what a terrible person I am and that I'm a terrible mom. He can't believe I'm exposing them to this. He went on and on, even telling me that he was going to report the truck stolen so that I would get pulled over and go to jail while my girls were with me. And now they had no parents. I remember getting back to my mama's and sitting on the edge of her bed, and I just started bawling my eyes out. And I finally started sharing with her what was going on, what I was going through. A lot of it was hard to put words to, and that's something that we're going to talk about in future podcasts, but I explained enough. She got in front of me and stood there and essentially told me that this is just a stressful time and that everything's going to be okay. You just need to go back to the mountains and everything will be fine. To this day, I think about that. It was not what I expected at all, and I don't understand it. None of my family showed up, pretty much, for Doug's funeral, other than my mom. Ken wasn't even there. And if they weren't there for him, I don't understand why they weren't there for me and my girls. Afterwards, there were no phone calls to check up on us. Nothing. It was like we were forgotten. On my way back to North Carolina, I was pulled over. It was the first ticket I ever had. I just knew the truck was reported stolen and I was going to jail. I was beyond stressed. My brain was maxed out. I got a $250 ticket for going, I think it was 44 in a 40 or something. It was like just a few miles over the speed limit. And it was right before Christmas. I don't know what that cop's deal was. But all I could say to him was, have a Merry Christmas. I shoved my grief down with all of the other bad stuff that's happened in my life. I just kept on trucking. It was the only thing I knew how to do. I never was taught how to deal with it. We didn't talk about anything, so what else was I going to do? Trying not to think about it or dealing with it was the only thing I knew to do. Things only got worse with the relationship that I was in. I was isolated. I was made to think I was crazy. I didn't know what was the truth, ever. If I ever got close to having courage to leave, he used Doug's suicide against me. He would tell me things like, I talked to him. Yeah, we talked. And he told me how crazy you are. You're the reason he killed himself. If you leave, I'll kill myself. And you'll have another man's blood on your hands. I mostly just gave up. Sometimes when I thought about it, I would think to myself, Heather, you deserve this. Look what you did. And I would just think of all these things that I had done. I never prayed. I never got mad at God. I never blamed God. I think because I didn't know who he was. So if I didn't know anything about him, how could I blame him? I just thought he was some guy up there in the clouds that judges how good or bad I am. To me, I was bad or I wouldn't be going through all of this. But I never thought that he was punishing me. November 2007, we were in Georgia at deer camp, and I stood up and spouted off something that made him and his family angry. I just turned around and left and headed towards where our camper was. I had no idea that he was behind me, apparently hot on my heels. As I stepped up into the camper, I felt him grab me from behind. He pushed me, running me through the kitchen and through the bathroom door into the sink and cabinet. I was stunned. He flipped me around. And he used his body weight to hold me up against the wall. He pinned me up against the wall and was holding me with one hand. And then he takes my hoodie and he wraps it real tight around my neck to cut off my breathing. He knew that this wouldn't leave any fingerprints. I tried to keep pushing him off. I tried to get him off of me. I didn't want the kids to see this. I just wanted it to stop. Their camper was next to ours and it was like in an L shape. And they were bathed and they had been fed and they were in their jammies watching a movie. He didn't loosen his grip and I started blacking out. I couldn't believe that he had went that far. He loosened up the grip and allowed me to breathe. I started fighting again and he torqued down on the hoodie again. I started going out again. He loosened. We went through this several times. I don't remember how many times, but it was several. And finally, at some point, I thought, he is going to kill me and my girls are going to be here alone with him. I fought my way from under him, blacked his eye, and made a run for it. I was trying to find my purse to get my keys. He beat me all over that camper while I was trying to get my keys. I finally got them and headed for the door. He got them from me and he threw them in the tall grass. As I went off the porch, I looked over at the picnic shed where everyone at deer camp was standing there watching all of this go down. Grown men watching him beat me. Mind you that those are men that I knew, I'd cooked for, I'd helped in many different ways, and I was always good to. I got on my knees and I was just going through the grass trying to find my keys, and he kept kicking me and punching me. I found the keys somehow and I headed for the camper to get my girls. By then, they had heard that something was going on and they started to come out the door. He jumped in front of the door and got between me and my girls. Him and I went at it again and I yelled at them to run for the Tahoe. They did, and I managed to get away and get in the Tahoe. It was November, it was cold, and we left with what we had on our backs. I had no one to run to for help because I didn't really know anyone. And the ones I knew, he made sure that I didn't trust them. I knew not to go to the house because he would be coming after me. After I got down the road a bit, I pulled over to get gas. I could see the interstate from where I was. It was early in the morning hours, so traffic was light, and I could hear his truck. Sure enough, he passed the exit. The girls and I stayed in a hotel and in my Tahoe for a bit. I filed a 50B against him and waited for court. I had never been a part of court like this before, and I was beaten down emotionally, physically, and mentally. Spiritually wasn't even on my radar. I went to court and met my appointed attorney that morning. I had never met her, didn't trust her, and I hadn't told her any of my story. I was scared to death and trying so hard to be strong. I was terrified to be away from my girls because I didn't know what to expect from him. He came into the courtroom with a grin on his face and with all of his family who kept staring me down. I knew that they were doing this because they wanted to intimidate me. That's how their family is. A lot of brokenness there. It was working, but I wasn't going to let them know that. He hired a local attorney who told the judge we were working on an agreement. I didn't even know what that meant, but his lawyer pulled me in the hallway and essentially told me what I was going to do. So of course I said, no, I'm not. He wanted me to drop the 50B because he wanted his guns back. The attorney literally cussed me. And the abuser had to give him more money so we could go forward. We were going to trial. We were waiting our turn, and eventually, I broke. I just wanted out of there after sitting and watching the other cases go before us. I agreed to drop the 50B if he gave me my stuff back. I dropped it. Never, ever did I get my stuff back. It was a terrible, scary experience. So around Christmas time, I was with some friends at their house for a get-together. I had a babysitter for my girls and was only like a minute from my house. I kept getting text after text and call after call from him. He would harass me constantly. The more I ignored him, the worse it got. He knew exactly where I was, and that meant he knew my girls weren't with me. It scared me so bad that I left. Before I could get there, he showed up and tried to come in the trailer. The babysitter fought to slam the door shut, and because he was so drunk, it worked. I got there and I ran in the house. I was trying to figure out what was going on, and he showed up again. He tried getting in, and we called 911. I told him I called them and he left. The deputies show up and they acted like I was white trash, essentially, and I was a waste of time. I showed them where he ran his truck into my Tahoe. The paint was there, transfer paint. And they said, well, he left, so go to the magistrate tomorrow and get another 50B. Because the one I had helped, right? That paper isn't going to stop him. I decided then that calling law enforcement was useless. He was a firefighter. They were cops. They all worked together. I put up with non-stop harassment until I moved back to Florida the following June. The girls finished their school year, so I moved back into a home I had in Florida. Someone who said that they would pay the mortgage, taxes, and insurance was living in it. They were supposed to be building their credit up and just get the home put in their name. They didn't even owe me anything. The payments were 3 months behind, and the county was about to put a lien on it for non-payment of taxes, so I had to kick them out and get all the payments caught up. I had a huge repair bill from the massive amount of damage that was done to the place. Cost me a fortune. On top of that, they were family, and I couldn't stand the thought of them struggling, so I gave them $2,800 to move out, to go find another place. So because of this issue, my own mama wouldn't speak to me for months. Again, I was alone. Weird things started happening and I was feeling really uneasy. I felt like I was being watched all the time. So then I just told myself it's because of what I'd been through. I was like, you have got to stop. He is 11 hours away. but I just couldn't shake it. One day, I go into a little local restaurant where someone I knew worked. I started asking questions about the 08. Turns out, her baby daddy was involved with them, and he ended up dead. I asked her why didn't anyone tell me what I'd gotten myself into out there? And she said, would you have listened? Fair enough. I have to learn the hard way. I explained my situation to her and how I was feeling and the circumstances surrounding Doug's suicide, and she suggested that I get out of town as quickly as possible. So my thought process was that I had two different choices. My abuser, a situation I thought I had some control over, or get a Colombian necktie, which is a way of having your throat cut, we'll say. One of the things that Doug said before he shot himself in front of the person who was present was that he was protecting me and the girls. I don't know what that meant, but there were other things that went along with that that made me feel like, nah, it was time for me to get out of Dodge. So the abuser won. He came down, loaded us up. I put the house up for sale and went back to the mountains. The abuse never stopped. I had finally had enough. I had to make it on my own, one way or the other. I had left this guy, I don't know, 4 or 5 times and somehow ended up back there. My girls had lived a life knowing that they had to have a grab bag ready to go at all times. I was over that. In 2010, I kept myself busy. I was teaching myself to can. I needed some jars, so I decided to go yard selling to see if I could find some. I got to the end of our road, and across the street is a shop where some equipment was kept. The garage door was open, and there was a yard sale sign. I walked in and walked around. I was looking, and this lady, being the salesperson that she is, walks over to me and starts asking me questions. So I started explaining to her that I was getting into canning and that I was just looking for some jars. So she told me that if I wanted to come down and hang out with her on her front porch, that she would teach me some things. So the abuser had gotten where he would go to South Carolina deer camp and leave me and the girls at home. And I thought, this is a good time to get out of the house. I started going down to her house with her and sitting on the front porch breaking beans and watching her grandkids and my kids run around the yard and play together. I trusted her and just started telling her a little bit about what I was involved in, and that helped me build up my courage. Not long after this had started, my girls and I were at their 4-H meeting, and I was receiving 5011 messages about how I was such a bad person because I had the girls out late at night at their 4-H meeting, and I just had enough. That was enough. I told the girls when we got home, go get your shower and get your go bags. Tonight's the night. We got to the house, and the girls started doing what they were told immediately. I walked into the bedroom where he was lying in the bed watching TV, and he started in on me immediately. I had bought Kelsey a lunchbox. I think I may have spent $6 on it. Well, I wasn't supposed to. Instead of working to keep the peace, I smarted off, and it was on. He had me in the closet, hitting me and pushing me around, and I was just trying to gather some of my things while he went crazy on me. Finally, I had got to the point where the girls and I could get out the front door and start heading for the Tahoe. On the front porch were a couple of little BB guns that my girls had played with, and they were sitting there. And for some reason, Kelsey's brain told her to grab those. So she grabs them and starts heading for the Tahoe. Well, he did not like that. So he started going after Kelsey. Well, of course, I started going after him, and my dog got in between him and Kelsey, protecting her. He ended up snatching the guns from her, and he started beating the pavement. He started beating his truck, his own truck, with those guns, breaking those guns. It was just a sign of, like, you can't have them, and I'm going to destroy them. I don't know. It was crazy. So the dog is barking and going nuts, and we're trying to get in the vehicle, and he starts yelling that he was going to kill every animal there. Listen, I'm an animal person. My girls are animal people. They had goats, and we had the dog, and I don't even remember what else we had at that time, but one of the things that Carly had was a show goat, and she had just gotten it for her birthday. He knew that that would destroy Carly and get a rise out of me. He knew that hurting the animals were a way of getting at all of us, and doing anything to my kids is a way of getting at me. This is also a man who hated my dog because he felt like I gave that dog more attention than I did him. He did not like that I had a relationship with my dog. I don't even know how to explain that. He was jealous of my dog. So to try to calm my girls down and not being sure what he was going to do, I said, come on. And we went out to the barn and we loaded the Tahoe up with goats and the dog and the kids. And as we were trying to get feed, he was running around yelling at us and cussing and getting right up on us and everything. And it was just pure chaos and terrifying. So we finally got everything loaded up and stayed as calm as we could and got out of there. We went and stayed with a friend of mine for a few days until we found another place to stay. The place that we found was surrounded by woods, but we had neighbors that were within the same area, the people who rented us the place. I felt kind of hidden, but then safe because I had neighbors, but we still discovered that he was dressing up in camo and sneaking in, and he was on my front porch, and he would always leave evidence letting us know that he was there. He wanted us to know that he could get to us at any time. Eventually, I met a man, and while visiting him at his house, our kids were playing together. I received text messages and they told me what a terrible person I was, what I was wearing, where I was, and what I was doing. It terrified me. I went white, I guess. The guy noticed that and said, "What's going on?" I tried to hide it because I didn't want him involved. He had kids. I didn't know what the abuser was capable of, so I was not trying to involve anyone. But he wasn't having that. He took the phone from me, read it, and that night he loaded me and my girls up. He took us back to our place and he packed all of our stuff. We moved in with him then. Turns out the lady that was teaching me to can is now my mother-in-law. Now, as you heard me say, our relationship went really fast, and while I do not suggest that, because there is a much better way, this is what happened for us, and neither one of us were walking with the Lord at that time. I'm not sitting here telling you that it's been a bed of roses either. I went from an abusive situation where I walked around as quiet as possible so I didn't get noticed by my abuser, to moving in with a man who was raising four kids on his own and with the help of his mama, and that was a lot. Just that in itself was a lot. There were times where Kelsey, Carly, and I sat on the couch watching everything go down, wide-eyed and frozen, thinking that we were in the wild, wild west. I never had a time to process what I had been through. I didn't think I had the time to do that. We were raising six kids who were playing baseball, football, softball, volleyball, doing rodeo. So I was pulling four horses around, then just their school. And then, because that wasn't enough, I enrolled full-time into college and was going to start in March 2012. Right before starting college, I was in the hospital with mono, and I came home and I was resting in bed when I received a phone call. A person who was supposed to be a friend, but was mad that I was seeing Brian, was my contact person for my mama at one point. I don't know if I hadn't changed that or if something got mixed up or what. I was busy. I may not have been paying attention to it. I don't know. So I received this phone call and she said, "I don't know why your mom had someone call me instead of Brian or Gail," which is my mother-in-law. Like, that was the important part of the conversation. "But your dad died." I'm sorry, what? Yeah, why would she have some cousin or something like that call me and just going on about having the issue that they contacted her instead of Brian or Gail? What she was alluding to was that she was right that I shouldn't be dating Brian, and that's why my mom had called her. That's where that was going. Not, "Hey, your dad has passed away. Where are you? Let me come to you." And no, none of that. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, okay, I just took it. I don't know why she did that. And okay. I immediately hung up the phone and called my mama. Someone from Ken's family was there, and I'd never met this person that I recall. She answers the phone and I say, "Where's my mom?" "She doesn't want to talk right now. She's resting." I said, "Who is this?" And she says her name. And I said, "Put my mom on the phone." "No, she didn't want to talk." I said, "What is going on?" "Well, Uncle Ken passed and she's resting. I'll have her call you back." Who does that? I was devastated. Devastated. I was so sick. I just learned the way that I'd learned. I'm trying to call my mom to see what's going on, and I'm being blocked from talking to my mom, who was 11 hours away. There was nothing I could do. Ken was diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver. Ken didn't drink. I may have saw him take one shot of tequila his entire life. He didn't drink. Here I was about to start school, and now And now that. My mom obviously doesn't even want to talk to me. She can't call me and tell me that Ken has passed. What do I do from here? I'm supposed to start school. Am I supposed to go to Florida next week? Like, what? I don't even know. Like, I'm totally lost. When I finally did get to talk to her, she was mad at me that I wasn't there. I still, to this day, have no idea if he was buried or cremated, where he is. I have no idea if he was saved and if I'll ever see him again one day. The whole situation is so messed up. I did what I usually did. I tucked it down away with all the other stuff that happened and went to work. I started school and just continued to live this crazy life I was living with all these kids and chaos. And yet I still worked hard and made the dean's list every quarter. I took it very seriously and wanted to be a good example to my kids. I was also the first one in my family that graduated high school, and now I've went to college, so I was proving myself. While I was in school, I kept saying, I am not going to do family law, I'm going to do criminal law. Some of my teachers kept saying, you know, you really have a knack for family law, you should do that. I said, no, I don't want to see families broke apart. I don't want to see it. So I had in my mind that I was not going to do family law. April 2012 rolls around and it's Easter. Brian and I are engaged and married on October 6, 2012. June 2013 rolls around and we get the news that my mama has lung cancer and it's inoperable and incurable. She was going to Tampa and staying with my aunt for treatments at Moffitt. She was so angry with me because if I was home, then she could have stayed home. I went down at one point and took her from Tampa back to Okeechobee to her home. She had 10 acres, so I did some cleaning up and mowing her property and cleaning, you know, just clean up around. And we got to spend some time together. We had some laughs and we cried together and we definitely had some arguments over stupid stuff. But one night while she was getting ready for bed, she was sitting up in her bed. We started talking and she just started crying and telling me how she didn't want to die. I had always taken care of my mom, and now what? I couldn't. I didn't know what I was going to do. What can I do to save her? How am I going to fix this? What do I say? It was such a really hard time that plays over and over in my head. When it was time for me to come back to North Carolina, I had to take her back to Tampa. She was angry. She wasn't going to be able to die on her own terms. Nothing I could do was right. Nothing I could say was right. It was just a difficult ride to Tampa. My heart was broken. I didn't know what to do. We made it to my aunt's and I stayed trying to spend some time with her. She went to her room, I guess unpacking her stuff, and my aunt and I talked for a little bit. And she came out. I hugged my mama tight and told her how much I loved her. And I turned and walked out the door and made the 11-hour trip back home on my own, alone again. I got home on, I think it was a Wednesday. Then Thursday was a football game for one of the kids. I was there at the football game when I got the call that an ambulance took her to the hospital, that she had a clot in her intestines, I think is what they were saying. There was nothing I could do in the moment, so I just sat there. In the middle of all of that cheering and talking, I just wanted to disappear. I just wanted to go crawl in a hole. It was the next day or so that I flew out and stayed with my aunt in Tampa. I went to the hospital alone. While I was walking towards the room they said she was in, they told me that they were just dealing with a blood clot in the intestines or something like that. Didn't sound very super serious. I wasn't ready for what I walked into. There was a male nurse fixing some of the tubes coming out of her and I stepped in thinking, was she going to be surprised to see me? And I said, hey. She looked at me and smiled. I immediately thought, oh, she's not mad anymore. She's glad to see me. The nurse turns around and starts talking to her kind of like a baby, which confuses me, and says, who is that? Do you know who that is? Her voice was different when she said no. The nurse didn't know who I was, so he was helpless as he saw the shock on my face. And I said, hi, mama. She said, mama? As if she was thinking that I was her mama. As I got closer to her, I realized that her appearance had changed drastically. She was withered up and didn't look like herself at all. She had no idea who I was. I had just been with her. I would have given anything to be back, even if she was mad at me in that car ride or wherever, just just to be back with my mom, but something had happened. I don't know if the cancer had gotten to her brain or what the deal was, but the nurse explained to me that he had just put mittens on her so she couldn't pull her tubes out anymore because there were tubes coming from everywhere. I just sat down in the corner of the room. I did not ask any questions because I didn't want the answers. I was there for, I don't know, 2 or 3 days, and my brother stopped by for a few hours. I never asked anything of the nurses. I don't remember doctors coming in. I'm not even sure why she was really on the machines, what the goal was moving forward. And eventually, they came to me and said that I had to make a choice to take her off the machine and send her to hospice. I did not want to make that decision. Once again, I was alone when I had to. I called my brother, who was working, so he couldn't come. I just sat there in a chair staring at that paperwork, the decisions that you have to make when it comes to that, the thoughts that go through your head, knowing that as soon as you put ink to paper, that person is going to be gone forever. There's no going back. Even the thought of Ken teaching me about our horses, let's say, when an animal was suffering that you had to put it down. And I knew that that's what my mom was doing with suffering. My mom, who my mom was, wasn't there. She wasn't communicating. She didn't look like herself. But I could see my mom there. I tried talking to her to see, okay, maybe there's something there. But there was nothing. So I signed the paperwork and I could still see it in slow motion in my mind. They told me that when they were going to disconnect her from the machine, that her heart rate would skyrocket and that she would have a heart attack. Because they were having an issue with that before, where her heart would just start beating so fast, like crazy amounts, and they would have to give her medicine to slow it back down. So they said, when she comes off of this is what's going to happen. And she probably won't make it to hospice, that she will die right here. So they start taking her off of the machines and nothing happened. Her heart rate didn't rise much at all. So that wasn't the case. So then I really start second guessing myself. Did I make the right decision? I am the worst daughter ever. I chose for my mom to die when she was still there. Like, all of these things were running through my head. So they said, well, we have to take her to hospice. They called the ambulance in, and as they were putting her in the ambulance, the only thing that she ever said was, ow, oh, it hurt for her to be moved. They drove her down to Sunrise City, Florida, and she made the ambulance ride. They got her set up in a room, and I went in and I sat with her and I talked with her, and I had to keep moving her up in the bed. I had no idea what was going on, how this was all going to happen. No one really talked to me. I think one of the hospice nurses talked a little bit, but not much that I can even recall. I tried to read her Bible verses. I had no idea what to read her. I didn't know anything about the Bible, and all she did was grunt at me. Until one day I was standing beside her, talking to her, and I leaned over and I said, Mama, just let go. It's okay. You can go. I'm going to be okay. Sean's going to be okay. You can go. And as I stood up, she looked at me and then she looked right above my head and her face lit up and she said, Ken! It took my breath away. I said, Mama, he's here. He's here to come get you. Go with him. And she just turned her head. She was refusing to die. Those days I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. They had said to me, don't give her anything to sustain life, but they weren't giving anything. I didn't know if I should give her water. Was that making her suffer more? I didn't know what to do. And I had no one to really ask. Nurses rarely came in. And it finally came to the point where I had a family to take care of and I needed to get back home to my kids. I had to get back home to school. If I missed school, then there were consequences that were going to be very hard on me and my family. I didn't know what to do. I had my back turned to her and I was just crying my eyes out. And then I hear her say, "Oh, poor baby." I just turned around and I said, "Mama, it's okay. I'm okay." I had to pack my things. I had to get on a plane and leave her there and come back to North Carolina. I can't even tell you how many days after that Brian got the call and said that she had passed. That was the day before our first year wedding anniversary. I don't know for a fact that she was saved. I asked my aunt and she assured me that she was saved, that her and my cousin had talked to her about it and she accepted it with them. She discussed it. I didn't even know at that time what that truly meant. I just knew I needed to ask. It was another blow that I just tried not to deal with and tuck away, though. At this point in my life, I didn't know if I was coming or going. Somehow, I had graduated from school and went to work in a family law office. That's where I landed. I was saved at this point. In 2013, I got saved, but I didn't truly understand what it meant to walk with the Lord. It's truly a terrible thing because this was such an important time for our children. Mistakes were made, our marriage struggled, and Brian and I spent more time worrying about where we were going to have a good time than anything else. Years of struggling go by, and in the beginning of 2020, I knew that I needed to do something else. Things needed to change. I was doing some counseling and even doing EMDR work, which was tremendously helpful. But I needed my work, my daily grind, to be something different. I left the law office the day that COVID really hit. There were a few things that I kind of started doing, but always felt empty. Something just wasn't right. Something was off. I knew I would start something and I was like, this is really not what I'm supposed to be doing. I knew that, but I didn't know where that was coming from or what that meant. And one day I'd been hunting and I got cleaned up enough to go check out an event with some friends and they sat down at a table. And as soon as I sat down, one of them introduced me to one of the other guys that was sitting at the table. He said, "Heather, this is my pastor." Of course, he was warning me because there was no telling what would come out of my mouth. So the pastor and I struck up a conversation mainly about how expensive hunting gear was, that clothes have gotten out of sight, and we talked about hunting. I didn't know that you could talk to a pastor like that. I held them up just like I did law enforcement when I was younger. They were at a, like, up on this pedestal and they could not relate to me. But this guy held a conversation with me. And one that I actually enjoyed and didn't feel judged or anything. I was kind of blown away. I went home that night and I told my husband, I said, "Brian, you know, I met this guy tonight who's a pastor at this church and I had this conversation and he was actually pretty cool." Brian said, "You know, Brandon has been telling me about that guy. And why don't we go check out that church on Sunday?" And of course, I'm not even going to lie. In my mind, I was like, I didn't say all that now. You ain't dragging me into church. But we did. And that was in October of 2020. And we have never looked back. I rededicated my life to the Lord and so did Brian. And my walk with him has been amazing. I am surrounded by people who are so kind and so loving, but also they're brothers and sisters to me. They're family. We give each other a hard time, but we also love on each other. I know there are several people that I could call at any point and they would be there for me. They would pray over my situation. They have lifted the names of my children. They have done intercessory prayer where they have went on behalf of my children to the feet of Jesus. If that's not love, then I don't know what is. I was isolating myself. I was in a deep, deep depression. Trust me, I could put on a smile. I could put on a mask, a face. I'd done it all my life. I was great at it. When you saw me out, I was smiling, I was cutting up, I was having a good time, but that's not what was going on inside. I was broken. I was disgusted with myself. I didn't trust anyone. My heart was hard as a rock. And then one day I invited Kristen, who is our pastor's wife, to come to my house and have lunch, which even Brian was surprised because I did not invite people over to my home. This was the place where I could hide out. But I did. And her and I had lunch and we chit-chatted and shared things with each other. And that was the first time I'd really gotten to talk to her. I didn't want her to leave. I enjoyed her so much. She was the first person who showed me what it was like to have a sister in Christ. And then I got plugged into a D group from there, which is a discipleship group. Those sisters, wow. They encouraged me. They prayed for me. They mentored me. And those women are still in my life to this day. I keep in contact with them. They are around me. We live life together. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I have never, ever had the relationships I have today in my entire life. I have grown and grown. My marriage has gotten so strong, so strong. I absolutely love my church. It's been life-changing. It's been life-changing for me, my marriage, my relationship with my children, my relationship with other people. You can say whatever you want about religion or whatever. I know my experience, and that's what I rely on. And hear me when I tell you this. I am not sharing my life like an open book on a podcast that is recorded forever and broadcast all over the world for anyone's pity. No, I'm sharing my story because I want you to know that little girl that was raped, neglected, let run feral, protected her mama and anyone else who needed it, had a miscarriage on a toilet at 13 by herself, watched a grown man die while she held his children, who felt like an outcast, grew into a woman who suffered depression and anxiety, went through losing the biological father of her children by suicide, and then blamed herself, who went through the loss of her parents, who moved 11 hours away because she thought that she would find her prince charming and found a jerk in tinfoil, was completely redeemed and restored by the most loving God and Father I could ever ask for. Now, there are some who would say, loving God and Father, then why did he allow these things to happen to you? Why wasn't he there for you? Why didn't he put a stop to all of that for you? That doesn't sound like a loving God to me, or a good father. I would say to those people, you missed it. See, Adam and Eve were in the garden when Eve was deceived by the serpent. He made her question God. Genesis 3:1. Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. But God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. But then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Satan has been making people question God from the very beginning. Just like you're questioning now. Eve fell. What happened after that? Adam and Eve hid from God. The Bible tells us that their eyes were opened and they knew they were naked. They were ashamed and even tried covering themselves and covering their sin by hiding from God. God told them to not eat of the tree because he was protecting them. Just like a father protects their children. When he tells them, don't put that butter knife into the light socket because he knows what'll happen. Same thing here. The father knew that his children would have knowledge that would make them feel ashamed. He didn't want that for them. Look what a loving father does next. He went and he looked for them, called to them. And Adam answers up to his father, just like a child does. Genesis 3:10. And he said, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself. He said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? The man said, the woman who you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree and I ate. Then the Lord God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? The woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. Then paradise was lost. Our Father is just and there are consequences. We have the curse, but after God gives the punishment, what does he do? Genesis 3:21. He covers them before he sends them out into the garden. Sin separated us from God. That sin landed us in brokenness. Turn on the news. Tell me the world isn't broken. You have all kinds of people who are looking for a way to fill that void. The void we all have. We know we are missing something. Something primitive in us tells us that we are missing something. People, we aren't just a bag of planet dust that formed into a conscious being. No different than an orphan child longing for their parent. We too have that feeling of longing, except we try to use things from this world to fill that void. We look for someone else to fill it. Like, as women, we look for men to fill it. Or we use drugs or alcohol to numb that feeling. Sometimes these things, these sins, hurt other people, and some of those people enjoy it. They get enjoyment out of hurting other people. They find joy in terrible things like murder and rape. I could go on and on. These things are here because of the fall, because of sin. The first murder was the second generation, Cain and Abel. Okay, then why doesn't God just make them stop? Because he gave all of us free will. You get to choose what you are going to do. He didn't create you into a robot that has orders to follow everything to a T. No, he gave you free will. You can choose to follow him or you can choose not to. But you have consequences, and those around you may suffer from the consequences of your actions too. Here's the good news though. He gave us a way out of this world. He sent his only son down to earth to be born by a virgin. His name was Jesus. He was God in flesh. That means he went through exactly what we go through here on earth as humans. He put on flesh like we have flesh. Although he never sinned, and yes, he was tempted by sin, Jesus was then hung on a cross and suffered the wrath that we deserved. He took our punishment. He was beaten severely to the point that he looked like hamburger meat. No, it ain't pretty. You need to see it. You need to get a visual of that. You need the truth. He suffered there, but never once did he put a stop to it because he loves you that much. There were people there that were yelling, "Crucify him." And what did he say? "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He died for each and every person, not just you, not just me, but every single one of us. He was buried, but then on day three, that stone was rolled away. He fulfilled the prophecy. He ascended back into heaven, and he's there now preparing a home for us. That door, that way out, that allows you out of this world and into an eternal life back in paradise is open. All you have to do is believe that Jesus Christ was sent to die on the cross for your sins, that he was buried and resurrected, and you got to give him lordship over your life. Then you too will become a new creation, just like I did. When I die, I know that I'm going to heaven forever. And my brothers and sisters in Christ, who have also been saved by believing, they will be there too. And I'll see them there. And there'll be no pain, no more disease and destruction, no more bills. But until that day, for now, I have hope. I didn't have that until I trusted in Jesus. I never knew where I truly came from and where I was going, what my purpose was. But I was created for a purpose in his plan. I have stability in that. I have a rock solid foundation to stand firm on. So now when bad things happen, because they still do, even though I've become a Christian, they still happen. I don't live in some kind of fairy tale. I just have an entirely different perspective on the way that I see things. I'm not a victim. And those wounds from others' sins that I've suffered, God is healing them daily. He does it when I walk hand in hand with him through his word, through the process of sanctification. And let's just go ahead and talk about this here. If you think good deeds will get you to heaven, like, I'm a good person. I don't murder and rape and this and that. And then think about this. How terrible would it be if we had to count on ourselves to do good deeds to get to heaven? I mean, seriously, we are rotten. If you don't believe me, put a camera, recorder, whatever, and constantly record yourself. Put it on you. Go back and watch it. I promise you will find something you didn't even realize that you did to hurt someone. Then there's measuring your deeds against my deeds. So what then? You get more than I do because you were a Girl Scout? No, it doesn't work like that. It's simple. Just believe. He already took your punishment. He already took the wrath of God. His blood is washing all of those sins away. No more. They're gone. And as you walk with him and you have a relationship with him, the fruit of that relationship will be what comes out of you. Galatians 5:22-23. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such there is no law. What if everyone had the fruits of the Spirit? That is what makes life better. So that's my story. For the women out there who, like me, have felt the weight of their past crushing down on them, for those who have lost hope in the midst of life's storms, for those who long for healing but don't know where to turn, I want you to know that there is hope. There is healing, and it's found in Jesus Christ. Through my story of redemption, I pray that you find the courage to believe that no matter how broken you may feel, you are never beyond the reach of his love. I truly look forward to having this journey together toward healing, restoration, and the abundant life that only he can provide. Thank you, Jesus. Sisters, thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, God bless you and keep you. Hey, sis. I can't even begin to explain how much it means to me that you are here and listening to this show. I am beyond grateful for you. If you enjoyed it or learned anything today, share it with your friends. screenshot it, share it on your Instagram and Facebook, and be sure to tag me in it so I can give you a shout out and a thank you. Don't be a stranger. Make sure you are following all of my social media accounts to keep up to date on what's going on. I look forward to discussing these topics and hearing your ideas on what you want to hear on this podcast next. So, find me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Hit the follow or subscribe button to be sure you are receiving those notifications when something new is happening. Please, and most importantly, help a sister out. Take a minute to show me some love. Give me some stars and write a little review on Apple iTunes. Send this Jesus-loving, truth-spitting, regular old country girl to the top of the algorithm so other women can find my content to help themselves or someone they love. Thanks so much for listening in, y'all. Remember, friends, forgive your enemies, it messes with their heads. Until next time, love and blessings, Heather.